Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Welcome. We focus here on sustainable innovations that make economic sense. And Bob Kessler, executive producer, scans the globe to find our guests. Bob, who are we going to meet and what are we going to learn this week?
Well, Robert, it's actually our good friend Chris Higgins of Urban Ag News. The issue of farm labor, what does that mean and how does it connect to what we're paying at the supermarket? So Chris will help unpack all of that for us.
Well, when it comes to food, everybody wants to know that answer. That and more coming up on Green Sense. Feeding a growing global population using less energy and inputs takes new technology and innovation. Hort Americas provides the most technically advanced and most cost-effective products for greenhouses and vertical farmers to grow more with less. It also has its finger on the pulse of controlled environmental agriculture as publisher of Urban Ag News. General Manager Chris Higgins joins us again on Green Sense. Chris, welcome back.
Thanks for having me once again, and thanks for the kind introduction.
Well, you are a leader in the industry, and we appreciate your time on the show. An issue that seems to be plaguing everyone, from field farmers to greenhouses to vertical farmers, is farm labor. Farm labor is an endemic issue. There doesn't seem to be enough of it. And what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be enough of it is key. And we don't. You know, I think the biggest thought for me is that we don't have people replenishing those who are aging out. So over the course of the last 10 years, we've seen the average farm labor age every year, the average age of the farm labor age every year. So 10 years ago.
Isn't that called a birthday, Chris?
Yeah, well, the average age of the farm labor, 10 years ago was 30. Now the average age is 40. So maybe I didn't do a good job explaining. But what that means is the people that are working our farms are getting older. And as we get older, this is, obviously this is not easy labor. As we get older, we become less efficient. So we have a couple of problems. We don't have young people coming in to farm, and we, are becoming less efficient in the field.
Well, let's talk a little bit about farm labor. It's easy to call that as a clump, just labor, but it's made of different categories. So why don't you break that down? What's the simplest farm labor to the most complex? And then talk a little bit about where the shortages are.
Yeah. So, depending on if you talk about a field or a greenhouse, let's use those two as an example. We start off with somebody who's doing the production management or the foreman. Then we have people who are expert growers or agronomists, and then we have those that are laborer. That's the most common way I think I would break it down. And so the laborers are going to be the ones that are doing the everyday task. They might be doing harvesting. They might be scouting for insects. They might be looking for problems in the crop and reporting those back to the head grower or an agronomist or a production manager. And then those are the people who are doing the cropping, right? You don't just plant a seed and then come back and harvest. There's tasks that have to be performed throughout the course of that crop.
Chris, is this skilled labor or unskilled labor?
I consider it skilled. There are many of those who would consider it unskilled. But if you've ever been working in a farm and you worked with, someone who's skilled at performing these tasks versus someone who is unskilled at performing these tasks, you would notice a huge difference in efficiency.
And is there a shortage in this category?
There is. Historically, there's, this has been a category filled by Hispanics or migrant labor. As it's been more and more difficult to get access to the Hispanic workforce coming from Mexico, it's created a big shortage.
And what about seasonality? Is this full-time or is this just seasonal work?
It really depends on if you're talking about a greenhouse or controlled environment agriculture versus a field. One of the advantages of controlled environment agriculture, greenhouse, or vertical farming is that we have production year-round. So this is, you know, this is year-round work. Now, if it's in the field, then depending on the crop or depending on the location of the farm, there's going to be seasonality to it.
Does that complicate the labor problem, not having a steady workforce and having to only hire it seasonally?
Yeah, it does, because it causes us to lose labor to other industries. You know, I think one of the most common one we usually see is losing labor to construction. So when there's construction booms, you know, if you're going to be performing labor tasks out in the middle of the sun, it's probably nice to know that you're going to have that job every day for a year versus, you know, doing seasonal work.
And what would be the next category of labor?
In terms of working our way up the hierarchy?
Yes.
Yeah. Then you would work your way. You'd work your way up to somebody who's going to be either a foreman, a assistant grower, or a full time grower. And those are going to be the people that have an education in agriculture, right? Those are going to be the people who understand a lot about the crop, can diagnose problems oftentimes by just looking at the crop, and oftentimes those individuals can see the problems before they occur.
And is this the part of the labor force that's been aging and hard to get young people to go into, or is this a growth potential?
I think this is a growth potential. Actually, the general labor is probably the one that's been the most difficult to find. We've seen a couple of big greenhouse projects pop up in Georgia. There's another one popping up in Kentucky. And it's interesting to watch the dynamics of those facilities as they try to hire local labor. Again, these are hard jobs, and local labor has a tendency not to want to do them. So these are the jobs that in the past we would have relied on immigrant labor workforce for. And these are documented positions, obviously. But we would rely on those people for those tasks. And now we are finding that we're having to hire more labor just to create the same task. And that labor is less efficient and oftentimes doesn't stick around because the work is difficult.
Is there a shortage of growers, or are the schools pumping up qualified applicants quick enough to meet the demand?
There is definitely a shortage of growers as well. As we have a boom in the ag tech field, we are seeing those who understand production being highly sought after. We also have something occurring where we have an increase in new crops, crops like hemp and cannabis. So those people who are investing in hemp and cannabis or investing in other ag tech businesses are looking for those people who are skilled in growing to bring on their team. So we now have more businesses searching for the same people, and historically we haven't graduated a lot of people with that skill set.
So with supply and demand comes economics, and with a short supply of labor, are wages rising?
Wages are rising, and that's also going to create a challenge for those farmers growing fresh produce, because while the wages are rising, the price at the price at the counter really isn't, or if the price at the counter is, it's not rising for many farmers as quickly.
Sounds like a conundrum. What to do?
Oh, that's a $1 million question, or a $1 billion question, probably.
Right.
I think what we need to do is look at the way we value our food. And I think, you know, we should expect that at some point in time, if we're not able to find technical solutions to solve some of these problems, that we might expect an increase at the counter.
Well, that's always the simple answer to agriculture: raise the price of the final unit cost. But it doesn't seem to be done very easily. So why is that? Why are prices always remain so low and the farmers get so little?
Yeah, I think it's because of the way the market works. The way the supply channel within the market works. The farmers don't have a lot of control. Most farmers don't have a lot of control over the price, the price at the grocery store or the price in food service. That part of the supply channel is controlled by, brokers, that's controlled by marketing companies, that's controlled by logistics companies. So that part, there's a little bit of a disconnect in where the margins for those products are held. Also, we look at what the consumer values. And that's something that, you know, I really don't think I'm qualified to talk about, but we do need to look at how consumers value their food and what they choose to buy based on what the cost is.
So if we can't raise the price easily and it's not controlled by the farmers, there's two other things they can do, and that's implementation of innovative technologies. And the last one, automation, which we're going to save for the next episode. So talk a little bit about the technology that's out there that can help reduce costs and maybe reduce labor.
Yeah. So right now, the technology that I'm seeing that's being implemented to help with reducing costs and labor really starts with the collection of data. Obviously, farms oftentimes are in a remote location. Getting internet access or some of these other things that have been important to collecting data has been a little bit slow. As we find ways to give the farmer or the farm the ability to collect data, what that's going to be able to do is allow that farmer to know better what he's doing and where money might be wasted, and use that data to make better, more informed decisions on how to become more efficient. I think that's the first thing we're going to see and that we are currently seeing. Greenhouses have started to implement that for a long time. The price for some of this technology is coming down. So smaller growers with less capital are actually now getting the opportunity to invest in that technology as well. So that's the first start. I think that's the first place to start. And that's where the farmer can collect their data, understand exactly what's going on, and then have the ability to make informed decisions, which will allow them to understand what to invest in, what not to invest in, and how to find any last area of savings that they might be able to find in labor.
Do you see more field farming moving indoors to controlled environment ag facilities such as greenhouses and vertical farms because they're year-round, they're using new technology, and they're more efficient?
I do. And it really depends on what we define as an indoor farm, right? Because there's a whole category of controlled environment agriculture that starts from a very low-tech facility like a hoop house or a high tunnel and moves its way all the way to a very advanced glass greenhouse or a vertical farm. So depending on the crop, depending on how long it takes to grow that crop, and depending on what kind of yields can be achieved with that crop, we are seeing people look at different forms of controlled environment agriculture to invest in. Now, some of the reasons they're doing this may not only be based on labor, it may be based on less and less insecticides or pesticides to choose from. So if you can't spray, if the consumer doesn't want to have pesticides on their product, then you have to look at ways of restricting how the pests effectively impact your product. Other things could be in mitigated climate change issues. So if you're going to be receiving more rain than what you normally would, one way to protect that is to put cover on the crop. So depending on what you're looking at, the move into a controlled environment ag facility is definitely increasing. It's just the reasons change by geography, by need, by crop, and by investment type.
Well, I think one of the big answers to agriculture is automation. So we're going to end on this and we'll pick that up next time we talk. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Urban Ag News General Manager Chris Higgins joining us with the latest innovations in indoor growing. This is Robert Colangelo, and you can subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Art can often bring attention to causes to inspire action. Currently at the Moody Center for the Arts at Rice University, students are combating plastic waste by creating sculptures inspired by coral reefs. We're joined by Alex Rovner, a senior at Jones College, who created the piece called Not Correlated. Welcome to Green Sense.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Alex, tell us what went into the reef you've created.
Yeah, so we collected basically laboratory waste from all the science labs on campus, included pipette boxes and tips, lab gloves, any sort of plastic waste we could find, and tried to just incorporate it into a giant plastic reef.
And you collected all this from on campus, you said?
Yeah, so all the labs that we collected from were Rice University labs.
And what inspired you to make it into a reef?
So I worked with a PhD student, and both of us do research in a lab on campus that studies coral reef ecology. It's pioneered by Dr. Adrian Correa, and we're both just very interested in coral reefs and have seen the effects that plastic pollution can have on coral reefs and decided we could have an impact.
What are some of the effects that plastics have had on coral reefs?
So it can have a variety of effects. Anything from, you've seen all the pictures of sea turtles that have straws stuck in their noses. Anything from plastic bags that sea creatures can think are food or jellyfish, but even smaller things, when the plastic degrades, it creates micropollutants that can actually really create harmful chemicals to all sorts of marine life. So it doesn't just end with, the macro plastics, it really gets to the micro level too.
Are you seeing any direct cause and effect from these microplastics to the actual coral reef?
Yeah, so I can't quote. There's a lot of scientific research on it. I don't have any articles on me right now, but there are harmful effects on corals that have been documented.
How long did it take you, and how did you go about constructing this coral plastic coral reef?
So we started collecting materials probably around late September, early October of this past year. And we collected more or less through January. And then we continued to collect a little bit from then until about early March. But most of the material we collected through then. And then starting in late January, early February was when we started building.
And how did you come up with this clever name, Not Correlated?
It actually wasn't my name. It was the PhD student Lauren Halker. She was the one that came up with it, so I give all the credit to her.
Have you ever been to a coral reef?
Yeah, I have a couple. Which I've been to some in the Florida Keys, some in Thailand, Bahamas. So I've been very fortunate. The coral reef that most of the research that's done in our lab is in Moorea, which is an island very close to Tahiti in the South Pacific.
Yeah, I've actually been to Moorea, beautiful area, and we do need to do a lot more to protect our coral reefs. When you visited coral reefs, could you see firsthand some of the destruction that man has caused?
Yeah, and it's actually funny because Lauren Howe Kerr, the PhD student I worked on the project with, isn't actually at Rice right now. She's in Moorea doing research. And the first day she was there, she was scuba diving just for fun, not collecting anything, just to get back in the way of, you know, swimming through the water. And she showed pictures of corals that had bleached since the time that she had been there last. So it was very sad to see that the effects are already, you know, taking hold even in Moorea.
I've had the opportunity to swim in another number of coral reefs, especially down in Florida, and you could really see the impact from agricultural or pesticide runoff and just man-made activity. So it's sad, and it's great that we could raise awareness. Raising awareness is great, and art's a great way to do it, but how do you really get people to take action?
I mean, I think it's an interesting question because there's a ton of scientific research that goes on to you know, study how we can mitigate the effects of, you know, coral bleaching and that sort of thing. But it's a conundrum because, you know, the scientific literature doesn't really necessarily reach the general public. It's kind of stuck behind these paywalls to get into these scientific journals, and it's not always the easiest to read. So I am a firm believer that, you know, not necessarily art, but visual imagery and ways that can be connected to the public. I cite the sea turtle with the straw image and the polar bear on the ice caps. Like, those sort of images, I think, have a much stronger effect than a research paper that might show, you know, the same finding. It just doesn't have the same magnitude of effect on the general public.
How have people been reacting to seeing the not correlated exhibit?
From the people that I've talked to that I've seen it, they're very impressed. And, you know, I was very surprised when we were making it, the sheer lack of knowledge about coral reefs in general, just not knowing, you know, if they're a plant, an animal, what they are, where they are. So I think, you know, at a base level, we're just increasing education about what these, you know, important and diverse ecosystems are, and hopefully raising awareness about, you know, how human impacts are causing them to be destroyed.
You know, your art definitely has raised awareness about keeping plastic out of the oceans. Do you think it's actually inspired people to reconsider how they dispose of plastics or how they use plastics in their everyday activities?
I hope so. I mean, I know that for me, it definitely has. I'm definitely more aware, even from before I started the project, that I need to be a little more conscious. But I think especially in terms of lab materials, there's definitely a lot of, I don't know, I guess, who you go through, but there's just so much that can be improved on, you know, the sustainability of lab materials and lab products. And I didn't realize how much waste was produced just through trying to do scientific research. It's kind of a paradox because, you know, we work in a coral reef lab to try and protect coral reef ecosystems, but you know, we produce so much waste that we're really contributing to the problem also.
What was the biggest lesson you learned, and what was the takeaway from creating this project?
I think the biggest lesson I learned, I guess, is I've always been a very, I guess twofold, actually. I'm a very math science person, and I never considered myself, you know, anything of an artist. And I think, for me, at least on a personal level, it showed me that you can do things that at first you know, had no conceived reality that it was possible for you. But on a more broad scale, I think the just the overall idea that visual displays and art and things that you wouldn't necessarily associate with science or math or engineering can really have a big impact on how it's perceived by other people.
Well, it's good to know that you're a senior, so that means that you're getting close to graduation. What do you hope to pursue once you're out of school?
So I'm actually planning to go to medical school. And my goal is hopefully in the future, I'd like to work in like sustainable medicine. So figuring out how we can maximize the benefits of medical technology while minimizing the cost, especially in like third world countries where resources might be limited. I think like sustainability and third world development are intrinsically linked together.
Well, that sounds like an admirable pursuit. Would you continue working in the sustainability realm or with coral reefs in your spare time?
Yeah, I think I definitely plan to, you know, keep up. I mean, I won't be able to keep doing my research because I'll be moving away, but I definitely, you know, plan to keep up with sustainability practices, you know, hopefully work on future sustainability projects in a variety of other fields. And I definitely will always be passionate about coral reefs. It's just something that has been such an integral part of my college experience, and I don't think it's anything that I'll ever be able to just toss away.
That's Jones College senior Alex Rovner talking about Not Correlated, which is now on display at the Moody Center for the Arts at Rice University. I'm Robert Colangelo, and you're listening to Green Sense. Subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com. We hope you enjoyed this edition of Green Sense. Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and you can check out the list of radio stations that air our show. All you have to do is stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Green Sense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright Green Sense Farms, all rights reserved.